Well, Hebrews chapter 4, verses 14 to chapter 5, verse 10 is what I've been asked to look at this evening. Our great high priest. Our great high priest. John H. Starkey was a violent British criminal. He murdered his own wife and was convicted for the crime and executed. The officials asked William Booth, founder of the Salvation Army, to conduct Starkey's funeral. And as Booth stood before the general congregation, history records he faced an ugly and mean crowd, one of the meanest crowds he'd ever seen in his life. And what do you say on an occasion like that when you take the funeral for a wicked murderer? William Booth's first words stopped the crowd and held them. It was this: John H. Starkey never had a praying mother. John H. Starkey never had a praying mother. You know, the power of prayer makes such a difference. My two children have never had a day when someone hasn't prayed for them. Be it mother, father, grandma, granddad, family members of the county's family, church members at Duncan Road. Someone has always prayed for my kids every day of their lives. But there are many who never have a praying parent. I did a school assembly, I may have told you this, it was a number of years ago now, in Parkgate School, and I talked about prayer. And two of the children went to Ruth Donaghy, one of the members of Duncan Road Church, who childminds for a few hours. And the kids went in and enthusiastically said, "Oh, we had Gordon come and do an assembly." And Ruth said, "What did he talk about?" They said, "Prayer." And she said, "Well, do you pray?" And they said, "No." She said, "Does your parents pray?" She said, "No." "Well, who do you know anyone who prays?" And they said, "The only one we know who prays is Gordon Curley when he does our assembly." How sad. How sad. Well, every Christian has someone who prays for them. We have a great high priest in the heavens. We have an advocate with the Father, the Apostle John says, using a legal term. One who represents us. He never pleads our innocence. He just has to show the wounds in his hands. And these verses in Hebrews remind us we have a great high priest. And I want to just ask three questions tonight to the passage. Here's the first one. Who is this great high priest? Look again at the text. Since we have a great high priest who has gone through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. Who is our great high priest? Jesus, the Son of God. He's identified to us. Now, while the name Jesus and the title Son of God are used on many occasions throughout the New Testament, you might be surprised to know this is the only time the name and the title are used together. You'd expect it to be common, but this is the only time the name Jesus and the title Son of God are used next to each other. And they're used to reveal the character of our great high priest. Jesus is the earthly name that was given to him when he was born in Bethlehem. It speaks of his manhood, fully human. Son of God is what he always has been and always will be. Speaks of his eternal Godship, his character in the Godhead. And together they remind us, he is Jesus, fully human. He is Son of God, fully divine. And together those two descriptions remind us, he is man as if he was not God. And he is God as if he was not man. You have two natures in perfect harmony in one person. I suppose like railway tracks, complementing one another, not fighting against each other. When the new parents went with their baby to get him examined by the doctor said to the parents, "You have a cute baby." And the father replied, "I bet you say that to all the new parents." The doctor replied, "No, only the good-looking ones." So the father said, "Well, what do you say to the other parents if the baby isn't good-looking?" The doctor says, "I tell them he looks just like you. Listen, we have a high priest who looks just like you. Fully human. Fully human. Man as though he were not God, and yet God as though he were not man. He is Jesus, the Son of God. So that's the first question. Who is this great high priest? The second question, what does this priest have to offer? Again, verse 15. Two qualities are mentioned. What does this great high priest have to offer? We do not have a high priest unable to sympathize with our weaknesses. But we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, and yet was without sin. Let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in our time of need. What does our great high priest have to offer? Sympathy and grace. Sympathy and grace. Look at the first characteristic, sympathize. He sympathizes with our weaknesses. The Greek term literally means he suffers alongside us. There's identification in that word. When we pray for those parents and family members of the students whose lives have been taken away in that high school, he knows what it feels like. He wept at the grave of Lazarus. He lost a loved one. Many believe Jesus, that the fact Joseph isn't mentioned, apart from the Christmas story, is that he died early. And so Jesus grew up as a single parent with Mary. His major influence. He knows what it's like to lose a parent, to be raised. He knows what it's like to be illegitimate. That's what they called him. We know who our father is. You don't. He knows what it's like. He can sympathize because he's been there. He has been tempted, not only in the wilderness by the evil one, who tempted him in a variety of different ways. Tempted through a friend, Peter. Tempted in the Garden of Gethsemane. Tempted in every way. There is not a temptation we face he has not been in one form or another. It might not be exactly the same, but the general principle of that temptation Jesus faced when he was in human form here on earth. Tempted in every way. And yet, without sin. I remember the first couple of computers I got, they don't seem to do it these days, although I haven't had a new computer for a while, but when I first got a decent computer, it used to have a big sticker on the front, and the sticker was this: hardware tested. Hardware tested. And what that sticker was saying is this: we've put this computer through the tests and it's come out positive. There are no faults within it as far as we can tell. Hardware tested. Our high priest has been tested as we are tested, and whereas we might fail, he doesn't. As a man when he was physically weak, as a man he suffered, like we get physically weak, like we suffer. As a man he knows what injustice is all about, for he was tried unjustly. In every way he can sympathize with you and I. And the second quality there, grace. Grace to help when? In our time of need. Did you notice about the throne that's mentioned in this verse? It's a throne of grace. Now that's unusual. Normally in the Bible, the throne of God is a throne of holiness. It is a throne of judgment. For example, Ezekiel. The brightness of the throne was the glory of the Lord, and he fell down upon his face before the glory. Isaiah saw the throne, and what did Isaiah say? Woe is me, I am ruined. The Apostle John saw that throne and he fell down as dead. But we come to a throne of grace. A throne of grace. And here in chapter 4, verse 16, we are invited with confidence. Isn't that comforting? It's not called a throne of truth, or the throne of holiness, or the throne of justice. It is a throne of grace. Our high priest does not sit in a heavenly courtroom, robed in contempt, scowling down from his bench with a gravel that he wants to bang down and say, guilty, guilty. The very opposite. The very opposite. He welcomes us to a throne of grace where we can find comfort and help and forgiveness. Grace is a wonderful thing. There's a story told of a politician. And he needed some photos done for publicity reasons. So he brought in a professional photographer. And he had an hour's session, and the photographer went away and sent through the photographs. And the politician phoned him up and said, I'm not happy with your work. These pictures do not do me justice. And the photographer replied, sir, with a face like yours, you don't need justice. You need mercy. Hey, we all need mercy. Did you notice in Hebrews 4 verse 16 the order given? Let me read it to you again. Let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive what? Mercy. And find grace to help in time of need. We come asking for mercy, not grace. And when we come asking for mercy, we find grace. It's important not to get the cart before the horse. We always come and we've got no bargaining power with God. It's never a case of pulling off a deal. If you do this for me, I'll do that for you. God doesn't work like that. That's the ways of the world. You do me a favour, I'll do you a favour. When we come to God, as with salvation, we say, God, I've got nothing to offer you. You're the God of the heavens. So I throw myself on your mercy. And when we do that, we discover his grace to help. Now, David Furlow is a friend of mine. I may occasionally say to him, Dave, if you do me a favour, I'll see if I can do you one. But in all the years I've known him, I've never said, David, I need mercy. Never said that. You say it rarely to an individual. Because when you ask for mercy, you've got nothing to bargain with. You just throw yourself completely on the goodness of the other person. I don't deserve it, but show it to me anyway. And when we come to God and we say, God, I have nothing to offer you but all this baggage. He said, well, that's where we start. When you come with the right attitude, you find grace to help in that time of need. And we come with confidence, with boldness, with assurance. That stops us from taking God for granted. Clicking our fingers and expecting God to jump. Stops us from presumption. Well, God will do it. That's his job. But we come and say, Lord, I don't deserve it. Please, please. It keeps us humble and a right perspective. Yes. And then we got this third question. Why does Jesus qualify as our great high priest? Why does he qualify as a great high priest? And there's a number of things in the passage, but I'm just pulling out two threads from chapter 5 and verse 6. Two things that make Jesus unique, that therefore make his ordination greater than any other high priest. The simple answer is this: he's been appointed by God. That's why he qualifies. He is appointed by God. Look at verse 5. He is a high priest forever. In fact, verse 6, he says in another place, you are a priest forever. Now, in the Old Testament, no human priest could go on forever. We're limited. 50 years, 60 years, 70 years. We lost our oldest member recently, but we didn't lose her. She was called to glory. 106, Lily Fielder. No one lasts forever. But that's a good word in the book of Hebrews. At least six times, the word forever is linked to Christ in the book of Hebrews. He is a high priest forever. Forever. And since he is a high priest forever, his ministry goes on forever. His salvation lasts forever. His work as an advocate lasts forever. In fact, he goes on to expand that in chapter 7, verse 23. He says, there have been many of those priests since death prevented them from continuing office. But because Jesus lives forever, he has a permanent priesthood and therefore is able to save completely those who come to God through him, because he always lives to intercede for them. So we have a high priest forever, forever. And then the second reason is in verse 6, halfway through. Let's read the whole verse. In the same way, Christ did not take on himself the glory of becoming a high priest, but God said to him, appointed of God, you are my son, today I have become your father. And he says in another place, you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Now, to the Jews, pedigree was important. Used to be important in the royal family, didn't it? Now they seem to marry anyone, even those jolly Americans. No, I'm half American, so hey, let's be in. But at one time, if you weren't, you know, pure kosher, you didn't get to marry a prince or a princess of the royal family. It's probably a change for the good. I'm not knocking it. But pedigree is important. And if you were Jewish, pedigree was very, very important. Because if you were to be king or a priest, you had to prove what line you came from, who your ancestors were. Did you qualify? Priests could only come from one tribe, kings could only come from another. Priests had to descend from the tribe of Levi. Kings had to come from the tribe of Judah. That meant no human being could ever be both priest and king. It was one or the other. Now we know that Jesus was from the tribe of Judah. He was a king. So how come he can be a priest as well? Well, this verse tells us. He wasn't a priest from the line of Aaron, a Levite. He's a priest in the order of Melchizedek, a character who was around before Moses and the law and Aaron. His priesthood goes way, way back. That's why he qualifies as both priest and king. Well, who's Melchizedek? Well, Melchizedek gets three mentions, really, in the Bible. His first mention is Genesis chapter 14. He's a mysterious character who appears from nowhere and then disappears three verses later. So you've got three verses in Genesis 14 about this priest. Symbolically, he appears and disappears. He has no beginning, he has no end. He's a type of Christ. He's called the priest of the Most High God. He's called the King of Peace. Salem means peace. And Melchizedek means King of Righteousness. So his name means peace, righteousness, sent from the Most High God. He's a type of Jesus, a foreshadowing. So that's all we get, three verses. Aaron recognized him and tithed to him and honored him. And then 1,000 years, not 100, 1,000 years goes by, and you don't hear of Melchizedek. His history. And then he suddenly appears again. One verse in Psalm 110, verse 4. Now, Psalm 110 is a messianic psalm, a psalm about the Messiah, a psalm about the Christ. Only one line. And in Psalm 110, verse 4, it says this: you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. So the psalmist says when Christ Messiah comes, he'll be a priest forever, just like Melchizedek. And to the Jew, like I say, that was an important psalm. And then he gets the third mention. So skip forward another 1,000 years. Genesis 14, 1,000 years, Psalm 110, and then another 1,000 years to the letter of Hebrews. And he gets mentioned eight times in the book of Hebrews. And he uses the expression order of Melchizedek four times. And the point is this: the writer of the book of Hebrews is saying that both history and prophecy support the validity of this priesthood. We haven't just invented it. Look at history, book of Genesis. Look at prophecy, what was predicted in the Psalms. It all supports this priesthood. And it's the priesthood that the Messiah comes from. So Jesus is unique. He has both titles of king and priest. He is appointed not by men. That was the priest of Aaron. but by God himself. That's why he qualifies to be our priest. So in conclusion, we have a great high priest, these verses tell us. He's accessible. He's accessible. He's only a prayer away. He is all sufficient. He meets all our needs. He invites us into his presence. And let me just go through verse 16 one last time, just as a kind of a conclusion. Who is invited? Let us come. No exceptions. He didn't say, those who have been praying more than the others, they can come with confidence. The others, well, they have to, you know, earn their stripes. No, he doesn't. He didn't say those who have been going to church the longest, those who know their Bibles best, those who have done most evangelism this week. No, he says, let us, ordinary Christians, with all our faults and failings, we're all invited to come. How do we come? With confidence. Because the invitation comes from him, not from us. He never lies. If he invites us, he means it. Where do we come? To a throne of grace. Why do we come? To receive mercy. When do we come? In our time of need. What a great high priest we have. Let's pray.